Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 3rd of April 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. What have we got for our audience today, Mike?
Sorry, but it's got to be Brexit to start with once again. Now, yesterday, as I was travelling in the car, listening to Radio 4 Today programme, Justin Webb had something to say which caught my interest. Let's just have a brief listen.
It is, of course, another day of political drama. It's more than that as well. There is a sense of this reordering of our politics happening around us with Brexit at the heart of it.
So a reordering of our politics, Brian, with Brexit at the heart of it. Now, of course, on Monday's programme, we highlighted that on Sunday, John Major had this to say. You know, he was talking about the way forward with respect to Brexit. He said one way. He was saying that Brexit, there could be no progress without a clear majority. And he was saying one way is a general election that produces that clear majority. And the other is to have some sort of unity or national government. And that idea was echoed by Nicky Morgan, who said it may well be, if you end up with a cross-party approach to finding a majority in the House of Commons, it might be that you need a cross-party approach to implementing Brexit. So, well, 7 hours or so of discussions in Cabinet, allegedly yesterday. Goodness knows what they were talking about for 7 hours, but anyway, that's how long it took. And yesterday evening at about 7:30 or so, Theresa May came out in front of the cameras to make a statement.
I've just come from chairing 7 hours of Cabinet meetings, focused on finding a route out of the current impasse. We will need a further extension of Article 50, one that is as short as possible and which ends when we pass a deal. This debate, this division, cannot drag on much longer. It is putting members of Parliament and everyone else under immense pressure, and it is doing damage to our politics.
So it's doing damage to our politics, so we've got to reorder our politics, we've got to come up with a new way of doing things.
And politics comes before the country. It's not about concern for people in the country, daily lives, earning a living, how the hospitals are running. It's about their politics.
Well, we'll come on to that in 1 second indeed. So what else did she say in that little speech? Well, the key point was that, well, she invited Jeremy Corbyn to get involved in discussions. That the withdrawal agreement as it stands is what is the way forward, because that's the only thing that the European Commission or the European Union has agreed to. So therefore that they need to focus on the future relationship with the EU. Now, of course, as we said before on this programme, it makes no difference whether we crash out with a no deal or whether we have some form of what they describe as an orderly exit. Because it's the future relationship that we've got to look at very closely, and there has been a political declaration on what that is. It includes things like defence and security and so on. So the future relationship is all about how we get back in, and as we've said on the programme before, this will create some new treaties, and those new treaties will not have an equivalent of the Article 50 procedure, you can be sure. So whatever we get into in the future relationship, we will find very difficult to get back out again.
It's going deeper into the mire, deeper into the bog.
Absolutely. So anyway, she has invited Jeremy Corbyn to get involved in this. She said that both she and Corbyn can take whatever they agree to the House of Commons together. Then that would be taken, if the House of Commons agrees, that would be taken to the European Council for approval. Now, if she and Corbyn, she said, if they cannot agree an approach to take to the House of Commons, then they would produce a series of ideas that could be taken to the House of Commons for the House of Commons to vote on, and that she would abide by the decision of the House of Commons. But to make it work, the opposition, that's the Labour Party, would need to agree with this whole scenario. And so far, so good. They seem to have agreed. Now, Corbyn still saying that he could go for a no-confidence vote. But frankly, if anybody has seen the Prime Minister's questions that's just taken place, Corbyn didn't mention Brexit once during his questioning of the Prime Minister. He was very soft on her. He was talking about poverty and the minimum wage and so on, and really not anything to do with Brexit at all. So as far as he is concerned, in the meantime, Brexit is off the table as far as Prime Minister's questions are concerned. So assuming that all goes ahead, they would bring forward the withdrawal bill before May the 22nd so that the UK would not be taking part in EU elections, members of the European Parliament elections. Brian, this looks to me very much like a government of national unity, in a sense, because Theresa May, no longer required to rely on the Conservative Party for a majority, she is now attempting to get into bed with the Labour Party to generate a majority for her deal in Parliament. Yep. She clearly thinks that she's got more chance of having the Labour Party whipped into line than she has of half of her own party. But anyway, this, as I say, this begins to look like a government of national unity, as Major was calling for.
Well, somebody in our chat box has commented that it is starting to smell like a dictatorship. My reply to that is, it's not a question of starting to look. The dictatorship's already formed. We've now got Parliament is out of control because this is just being run behind closed doors. Policy chosen by the Cabinet Office, enforced by the whips. This is a major breakdown, Mike, of the Constitution, in my opinion. I may be wrong.
No, you're absolutely right. Now, in the chat box, they're saying, are they going to agree to a second referendum? That's quite likely, I think. No guarantees. Yeah. You know how it is with this. It could change on a daily basis, but it's certainly looking very likely that that's how it would end up. The question is what would be on the ballot paper. But anyway, also on Monday, we pointed out that Julian Smith, the Tory chief whip, had said that the government should have made clear after the 2017 election that it would inevitably have to accept a closer relationship with the EU after Brexit. This is the fraud of the whole thing and has been since 2016. There was never any intention to have anything other than a closer relationship with the EU after Brexit. And what we've seen is the use of the chaos of Brexit to hide all kinds of ills, including this.
And another excellent comment there, which has just come up on screen, the rolling out of agendas behind the smokescreen of chaos.
Yes.
And that is exactly what this treasonous parliament is doing.
Yes. Now, another constitutional related document on the UK column, article on the UK column website. Now, this is Lord David James. Now, this is Lord James of Blackheath, the man who spotted the first lead that revealed British and Israeli involvement in the Iraqi supergun affair. In 2010, then he was the only peer to raise the issue of the national debt in the House of Lords. So he's released a paper, which we have published here with permission, which calls upon the Lords to prevent the Crown from breaking the Constitution by acting in breach of the monarch's oath of office to uphold the Declaration of Rights, 1689. Now, why is this important? Well, he says here that this is contrary to the popular vote, which the government has promised to deliver. It's utterly inimical to our constitution. It will involve the creation of a European standing army and loss of control of our defence forces. And, this comes back to the issue of the political declaration on the future relationship with the EU, which does include security and defence. The key point here is that the Bill of Rights, a written part of our constitution, absolutely prohibits the UK from having a standing army. We do not have a standing army. There is a procedure followed each time there's a new parliament, where the parliament has to renew the army for a further period of time. And the idea of this is that it limits the executive, i.e. the government, from pursuing a war that the people don't agree with, because if parliament has to renew the army each time and it refuses to renew the army while the government pursues an illegal war, for example, then they would not be able to pursue that war if the army ceases to be. So this is a key constitutional protection, and it's something which is, as part of the future relationship, is being pursued, a standing army within the EU. And if we enter into treaties which oblige us to contribute to that, constitutionally, we're not able to do that.
We're breaking the Constitution.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that is an extremely important article. It's doing very well on the UK column website at the moment, and we would just ask people to share it as widely as possible.
Yeah, and I think we really need to push that. If you want to help what we're doing, if you're concerned with what's going on, post that, the link through to that article, get onto some of the Twitter pages of politicians, get in amongst the comment and direct people to that article. This is how we spread the information.
Now, quite a bit of furore this morning with this little video clip, which has appeared on social media. And it shows, it appears to show some paratroops, some paras, shooting at a target. This apparently was taking place in Afghanistan. And when the camera pans around, as you can see there, it seems that the target that they're shooting at is Jeremy Corbyn. But quite a furore on Twitter at the moment. I don't know what your thoughts are on this, Brian.
Well, when it was first mentioned this morning, I did a wry smile, maybe a bit of black humour, because all sorts of things in my time got posted to be used as targets. This is the sort of black humour that military people use sometimes to take the heat off a situation. I found it very strange that they would simply choose Jeremy Corbyn as the target. And to me, this smelt of a sort of political agenda that at this time when MPs are being deliberately made fearful, we've got troops shooting at Jeremy Corbyn. Of course, if you look at the comments now being widely posted, a lot of troops are saying, well, actually, we pick all of these people as targets. That's the black humour. Mm. But how this has quite been managed, Mike, I don't know. I smell that this image is being promoted on social media, and it's getting a helping hand from the establishment in order to use it politically, when in fact this is a bit, you could say it's disgraceful, it's nonsense, all those things, but do troops get up to this sort of thing as a way of taking the heat off what they do? Yes, they do.
So but, the key point here is to ask the question, why this particular video clip and why now?
And why it's got such power behind the circulation.
Yes. Okay, now let's head over to the United States. And well, here we've got Donald Trump, and the man standing or sitting with his back to us is Jens Stoltenberg, as you can see, the Secretary General of NATO. So he has headed over to the US because it's NATO's 70th anniversary in the next couple of days, and there's a big anniversary bash going on over in Washington. So Stoltenberg was giving his opening speech. He went a couple of days early to meet Trump, and he gave an opening presentation yesterday where he made it clear that the main issue for NATO for the next 70 years, I suppose, is countering Russian aggression. He made a huge deal of that. Now he's going to be speaking to Congress today at the invitation of Nancy Pelosi. He said that stepping up NATO's actions in Poland, Ukraine, Georgia, all the nations bordering Russia are red lines for security. He is concerned by Russia's pattern of aggressive behavior, including its ongoing actions against Ukraine and the seizure of Ukrainian sailors and ships near the Sea of Azov. He is stepping up NATO's presence in the Black Sea. He said that NATO's ongoing exercises in Ukraine and Georgia were to step up NATO support for both Georgia and Ukraine in areas such as training of maritime forces and coast guards, port visits and exercises, and the sharing of information. So that's fantastic stuff. But unfortunately for Jens Stoltenberg, once again, Donald Trump doesn't seem to have read the script, because during the question and answer session afterwards with journalists, this is what he said.
I hope that it's not going to be a security threat. I hope we have a good relationship with Russia and with, by the way, China and everybody else. But I think the fact that we have NATO, and NATO is a lot stronger since I've been president, would you say that's correct? We've taken a lot more money. And
allies are investing more, and that provides them new capabilities we need to maintain credible deterrence and defense for all NATO countries.
But I think we'll get along with Russia. I do believe that.
So he believes that he's going to get on with Russia, but NATO doesn't believe that they're going to get on with Russia. Russia is the problem. Now, you'll also notice in that little video clip that that Trump made a big deal of the fact that EU countries are now contributing more to the NATO pot. Of course, that followed his visit to Brussels in 2015, when he effectively threatened the European countries that if they didn't step up, and start paying into the NATO pot, that basically the United States would withdraw quite a lot of the money that they're providing. So it was a bit of a threat. But of course, this issue of funding for NATO isn't really about funding for NATO as an organization, because everybody that's a member of NATO pays their membership dues, which supports the administration of NATO and so on. This is actually about defense spending. And so Trump's little hint there is actually all about European defense union. And the creation of European Defence Union, and you know, part of that is the increase in spending EU-wide. But anyway, you know, Brian, as I say, he went there with the message that Russia is the enemy, and yeah. Trump, once again, not quite on script.
It's an amazing situation, Mike. There's split personality at work, and I'll come on to that a little bit more in a minute. But basically, the Europeans can't do it. Can't do defence without the Americans, and this has always been the case. And we've got all these EU politicians pretending that the European Union is capable of becoming a military superpower, but actually the reality is that behind the scenes it's chaotic, it's a mess between all of the nation states. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch how this pans out. But here's the proof of the pudding that, of course, Brexit was the biggest lie that the Conservative government ever pushed. We got Plymouth Live, 2,000 British armed forces being deployed to bolster European security. And of course, as you've just pointed out, Mike, this is all to do with bolstering the European Union's eastern border. So this is expansionism. And of course, it is provoking Russia at each stage. Almost 2,000 British Armed Forces personnel will be deployed to the Baltic Sea for a series of multinational exercises to bolster European security, the Ministry of Defence announced. The MOD said that's supposed to be Royal Navy. That's not our text. That's Plymouth Live. Royal Navy sailors and Marines will be joined by 1,000 others from UK-led high readiness joint expeditionary force nations for the Baltic Protector. So you see what's going on here. We haven't got the troops ourselves, but we are leading all of these other nations. So the other nations are going to provide the cannon fodder. Meanwhile, it's British Parliament that's in ramping up the aggression against Russia. So here's all of the exercises, but this one takes the biscuit. This is our old friend, the Minister for War, Gavin Williamson. And he said this: as Britain prepares to leave the EU, our unwavering commitment to European security and stability is more important than ever. Deploying our world-class sailors and marines to the Baltic Sea alongside our international allies firmly underlines Britain's leading role in Europe. Now, I have a problem with this. So we're leaving the EU, and in doing so, we're playing a leading role in
yes,
the EU.
In the EU yes,
so
yes.
Split personality or pretty dangerous cognitive dissonance.
Or they're simply lying about us leaving the EU.
Exactly. So this is what we feel that our audience should be concentrating on. Every word that our politicians say, every word should be checked for whether it's truthful. And on the subject of truth, of course, this is something else that we predicted. It was going to take British NCOs to stand up, non-commissioned officers to stand up to really say what was going on. And this is a film clip from a talk in London, UKIP talk. But this ex-para NCO veteran stood up and gave a fantastic speech all about EU Defence Union. He talked about unification. He talked about the fact that Britain was still committed to this EU Defence Union project, even though there was talk of Brexit. And he said that basically people had now got to tell the truth about what was happening because the British government wouldn't tell the truth. And I just added on screen in the text there that amazing courage of this man to stand up on a big stage and really tell it as it is. Meanwhile, we've got senior, very senior, retired British military officers who, quite frankly, are too scared to actually get into the public domain and challenge this government of occupation. So I'm going to say Well done to Maverick Veteran for having the courage to do this. We'll help people see that clip. I'll tweet.
You can just search for Simon Bean MBE, and
it'll come up.
It was Friday's Brexit demonstration he was speaking at. It's easy enough to find on YouTube.
Yeah. Okay. So now let's follow that along. If that's what the veterans are having to do, let's come to local MP Johnny Mercer. Of course, a man who is out there. Here's his Twitter page. He's glad handing it with the Chelsea pensioners. This is a man who's served in the military, and he says that he's fully behind his country. But there's something not right. So his lead tweet, when I looked at his site earlier, was "The country is more angry and divided than ever. There's never been such an important opportunity to use politics to change lives for the better. Watch my speech." So I just took a little clip of this, should run on screen. Basically, I'll just read a bit rather than listen. But he said he didn't set out to be an MP. It wasn't in his blood. But he just saw the need to do something in the country, to stand up and be counted, to run for Parliament. He says that everybody's seriously angry out in the country. They're disconnected from Westminster. People say that politics is dead, but he doesn't agree. And if we just wait till it just gets to the end, we suddenly get a little look into his mind. He's saying people want to change the political system. We've got to be moved. We've got to believe in the country. We've got to seize the moment. We've got to face up to failures. On it goes. We have to change politics.
Uh-huh.
We have to change the game. We have to change for the better. Everything is changing. Some things are not stable. The horse has come out. He goes on, and eventually he ends by saying, "We have to change the world."
Right.
Okay. So all of this speech now is about grabbing younger people and changing the whole face of politics. So this to me seems like an agenda which has been sold across the political system, but we can't even run Britain at the moment, or these people can't run Britain, but in his head we're going to change the world. This is a bit like Amber Rudd the other day. Every child is going to live a superb life.
I mean, many people perhaps wonder why we suggest that the chaos that we're witnessing at the minute is something which is planned and intentional. And you know, the key point here is that you can't have change unless people are unhappy about something.
If you can destabilize, if you can make people unhappy, then the people want something to change because they want to get rid of the chaos and unhappiness. So I decided to get on to Johnny Mercer's Twitter page. And this is the post that UK Column did down here. What did I say to him? Well, I said this. Hang on a minute, Johnny. Your ACT Conservative colleagues Nick Bowles and Danny Kruger warned the public just a few years ago that the Conservatives plan to foment chaos in UK to achieve their political new society. You're still a member of the party that's driven the chaos.
Can I just point out that Nick Bowles isn't, of course, because he resigned yesterday.
This is true, but for the point of this, Mike,
yeah.
Nick Bowles said very, very clearly that the Conservatives plan to introduce chaos in the country in order to get their political change programme through. And Danny Kruger, who was a Conservative parliamentary candidate, reinforced that. Both men were heavily censured. So we know that the chaos has come from a deliberate agenda within the Conservative Party. Now, apparently, Johnny Mercer is what? He's ignorant. He doesn't know. He's not bright enough. Or does he know? Which is why he's now calling for even more change. Mm. I don't know, but I think a lot of people need to ask some questions.
Yes. OK. Now, a quick reminder that if you like what we do and you'd like to support our work, then please get over to ukcolumn.org/community. We would be very keen for you to take out a membership. Be much appreciated. So let's move on then to this. An interesting little post on Medium. Now, this is from a guy called Andreas Gall, who was formerly working for Mozilla. Now works for Apple. He headlined this, "No one should have to travel in fear." So he was clearly quite spooked by what happened to him when he tried to re-enter the United States just before Christmas. He's just posted this story, but it is about something that happened before Christmas. This man is a US citizen. He said that, "I signed up for the Global Entry Program years ago. It allows me to bypass the queues using an electronic kiosk. On this trip, the kiosk directed me to a Customs and Border Patrol agent who kept my passport and sent me to secondary inspection. There I quickly found myself surrounded by three armed agents wearing bulletproof vests. They started to question me aggressively regarding my trip, my current employment, my past work for Mozilla, a non-profit organization dedicated to open technology and online privacy. The agents proceeded to search my belongings and demanded that I unlock my smartphone and laptop. Because I was uncertain about my legal responsibilities to my employer, I asked the agents if I could speak to my employer or to an attorney before unlocking my devices. The request seemed to aggravate the customs officers. I declined to answer any further questions and continued to ask to speak to an attorney instead. The interrogation and threats continued for some time, which I endured silently." Now, he was subsequently released without having to unlock his electronics. But he goes on to say that, "As I've learned since, my experience was not unique. While CBP has a long history of mistreating foreigners, immigrants and asylum seekers entering the US, more recently the CBP has also started to aggressively question, unlawfully detain and in some cases physically assault US citizens crossing the border. These so-called border searches are not random. NBC recently reported that CBP maintains dossiers of US citizens and targets lawyers, journalists and activists and monitors social media activity of US citizens." So this is going on, Brian, in the United States at the moment. But of course, in a small way, we've seen the same type of activity in the UK with Ian Crane, if you remember, a year or so ago, being stopped at Exeter Airport on the way back from getting off a flight. So it's not unheard of for people to be apparently that are in the journalism or the activism community or who are privacy campaigners to be targeted in this country as well. I just wanted to highlight that because I thought it was an interesting development.
Well, I find it interesting, Mike. He came through San Francisco Airport.
Yes.
I would just go back to my own trip to the States a few years ago when I went through Los Angeles. Absolute brutal reception by the security at that airport. It wasn't just the experience for myself and my wife, it was also for other people there, including some very large Chinese parties. Very, very brutal and intimidating. But when I came through San Francisco a year later, totally different. The staff I found to be very pleasant. So I'm now wondering if there's been a major change at San Francisco that really there's a clampdown occurring in US.
Airports. He's implying deliberate targeting, so it may not be a general thing, but nonetheless, it could be heading in that direction. Now, yesterday, Mark Zuckerberg, I'm sure the Irish were delighted. Mark Zuckerberg was visiting Dublin to visit Facebook's offices there. He was talking about the need for social networks to do much more to regulate content that's harmful. So this is what he said: "We're going to have responsivity for making sure that we can police harmful content and get it off our services." He said this to RTE yesterday. He went on to say, "I think these days a lot of people don't want tech companies or any private companies to be making so many decisions about what speech is acceptable and what is harmful content and what is harmful content that needs to be taken down. So I think there's a role for a broader public debate here, and I think some of these things would benefit from a more democratic process and a more active government role." Well, this is fascinating to me because, of course, we've got to remember that it was really Theresa May that began this whole process, because not long after she became Prime Minister, she invited the social media companies, the heads of the social media companies, or at least their representatives in Europe, in the UK, to come to Number 10, where she began this process of getting them to engage on the issue of what she described as extremist content. And particularly of concern to her at that time was right-wing extremism. And here we have Zuckerberg now, who's publicly been up until now been sort of trying to push back a little bit on this, now saying that actually that he's encouraging government involvement. Well, this has been echoed by Martin Moore from King's College London. Now, Martin Moore, formerly Media Standards Trust, he gave evidence to the Leveson Inquiry in 2011 on the activities of the media at the time. But he made a statement recently saying it's clear that something has to be done to combat harmful content. This is on social media, but we will quickly descend into arguments about what harm is. So anyway, this is a statement that he made because the government is going to be publishing its white paper on internet regulation in the next couple of days. And as I say, Britain began this process, but it's also France, Germany, Belgium, a whole bunch of other countries getting involved, the United States as well, getting involved in calling for regulation of social media companies in particular. But in the UK, the recommendation is believed to be one of a statutory regulation, a statutory obligation on social media companies to police, monitor and remove content that is perceived to cause harm online. And this has come out of the House of Commons Science and Technology Committee and the House of Lords Communications Committee, who have both called for an online duty of care, as they're describing it, for internet companies. And also the Children's Commissioner for England, Anne Longfield, has called for the same kind of thing. So the term to be used now, Brian, is that social media companies have a duty of care to protect their users from extremist content. How that's defined is going to be very interesting to see. But this doesn't leave me feeling confident that freedom of speech is going to be something that we can look forward to in the not too distant future.
Particularly when you've had people like David Cameron, inverted commas, in bed with Google via his personal relationships. And we've got Nick Clegg buried into Facebook, I believe, now, haven't we?
Well, absolutely.
So we've got British politicians inside the very organisations that supposedly the politicians are trying to control. Mm. It's a stitch-up, I think it's correctly known as.
But good news, Brian, because apparently the number of cyber attacks on British companies and charities has fallen in the last 12 months. Fewer businesses have identified breaches or attacks compared to the 2017 survey. So this is the 2018 survey. It's called 2019 because it's just published, but it's about last year's statistics. They're saying that around a third of businesses and 20% of charities reporting having cybersecurity breaches or attacks in the last 12 months. As in previous years, they say this is much higher, specifically amongst medium-sized businesses, large businesses and high-income charities. They say among the 32% of businesses and 22% of charities facing breaches or attacks, the most common types are phishing attacks and others impersonating an organisation in emails or online, and viruses, spyware or malware, including ransomware attacks. And they're saying that for businesses, the proportion identifying breaches or attacks is lower than in 2018 and in 2017, and it's the same for charities. So they're saying that this is all a result of the fantastic data protection laws that have been passed in the last 12 months, and therefore businesses are taking cybersecurity that much more seriously, and they're suffering fewer attacks as a result.
Yeah. I'm sitting here, Mike, and I'm just remembering back to the days of simple transaction where you signed a check and you signed your own name on that check. But of course, we were then told that that was very vulnerable to fraud, and we were going to bring in the system of PIN numbers and digital security. And all of a sudden, that's exploded into everything but security for people.
Of course, one of the things it's exploded into is a whole new industry. But anyway, sticking on the cyber issue, the Mail had this today, which I thought was really interesting. Iran is behind a wave of cyber attacks targeting the post office and other key parts of British infrastructure. And I was fascinated by this. So as I read down the article, Brian, I was looking to see who had made this claim, because the headline says spies believe. Well, in fact, as you read down, you discover that this information has come from an unnamed, unsourced Californian organization. We don't know who it is. We don't know what their connections are. We don't know anything about them. But they have apparently made a claim that says that Iran was behind targeting the post office. yes.
I love the picture as well, because we've got the hoodie. If you get into cybercrime, you've actually got to wear a hoodie, even though you're in quite a nice office with lots of computer screens.
Yes.
You must have your hoodie on. And I think this is fake news anyway, because targeting the post office, is it the post office? I believe that it's, isn't it run by the Germans now? I can't quite remember the status of the post office, but I have a feeling that Germany's in there somewhere. So well done, the Daily Mail.
Yeah.
The reason, of course, that the government is terrified of accurate social media is because the truth comes out. And why do we need to get the truth out? Because the world at the moment needs to know that Britain is running a gulag system where people who challenge the government, people who can expose the government crime and wrongdoing, are likely to be imprisoned and or put in psychiatric units. This is the gulag system that of course was run in Soviet Russia. That same system is now here under the surface. And I'm very sorry to say that the latest news that we've had, and I've taken news from social media, where yesterday there was a court case, and we in that court case, Melanie Shaw, the Nottingham Beechwood Children's Home child abuse survivor, has been sectioned now to Rampton High Security Mental Hospital as a danger to the public. This is an old image we've used before, but it's got Theresa May. Of course, Theresa May was Home Secretary when Melanie Shaw was being held in solitary confinement. Melanie spent probably 19 months, probably more than 19 months in solitary confinement. And of course, when she ultimately broke mentally, then what did the British state do? They simply made sure that she disappeared into a high security psychiatric hospital. Why are the British government so frightened? Well, they're frightened because, of course, the engine of British politics is child abuse and the blackmail of people involved in that child abuse. Theresa May, now Prime Minister of Britain, and of course she's certainly not going to lift a finger to help Melanie or anybody else who may present a danger to the Conservative Party. So I'm just going to say I'd like to thank GGT, because this is one of the reports from outside the court where people were talking about what had happened to Melanie. My feeling at the moment is it's going to take massive support for Melanie across social media to stop this lady simply disappearing into Theresa May's Conservative prison psychiatric gulag. I find this obscene, Mike, because if I go back to my time serving in the military, at that time I thought I was there doing a job to help protect this country and its institutions were worth protecting. Now, under the veneer of respectability, it's clear that we're living in a criminal dictatorship.
Well, one of the things I particularly find obscene about this is that while Melanie was on, segregation for so long, effectively a form of torture, she was at least still able to receive messages of support and gifts and so on. But this seems to be not the case in Rampton. Rampton are refusing to tell anybody what ward she's on. They're refusing to allow any contact with anybody, no phone calls and no communications of any kind by mail. So this seems like complete isolation, utter and complete isolation.
Yes, and indeed we can say that certain key people connected with Rampton seem to be within the field of care within Nottingham. I'm choosing my words very carefully, but I don't get a warm feeling about some of the people who should be caring for Melanie Shaw. But totally isolated, she has literally disappeared into a gulag. Who is responsible for what's happened to Melanie Shaw? The British government is responsible. And of course, that's not an organisation. That is named individuals, of which Theresa May must come very high on the list because she was Home Secretary at the time Melanie Shaw was being brutalised in prison. Now, let's remind ourselves that the Conservatives' child abuse inquiry, ICSA, refused to take evidence from Melanie Shaw. So the inquiry says, if you've got any evidence about the abuse of children, we want to speak to you, except, of course, if you're Melanie Shaw, where for some remarkable reason they don't want to speak to her. And if the Conservative parties are, squidgy on the subject of child abuse, I'm going to thank the lady who sent me this morning. She'd picked up that Lord Lexton had been speaking in the Lords about police recruitment. He said, "My Lords, will these reforms mean that in future only men and women of the very highest ability are appointed to the post of Chief Constable, unlike Mr. Mike Veal, whose disastrous Operation Conifer has inflicted such dreadful and unfair damage on Sir Edward Heath?" This made me feel quite ill, Mike, I think is the best way I can put it. A little bit of research and you find that Lord Lexton is the official historian of the Conservative Party. Maybe that's why he's a little bit sensitive on the subject, but he uses his power and privilege in the Lords to attack a very brave police officer for doing his job. I find this, I think the word is obscene. Mike Veal stood up to do his job without any form of bias or favour. And of course, the report that he put forward indicates that there were certainly questions to be answered by Ted Heath, were he still to be alive. But none of this has been brought into the public domain. Instead, he was hounded with a series of childish claims that he damaged a mobile phone and he'd leaked information. So the state has gone for this man because he did his job of investigating Conservative Prime Minister Ted Heath for child abuse. And I'd just like to bring in alongside this those comments from Ken Clark to the ICSA child abuse inquiry, where he said, well, of course, at his independent school, at his school, there was a paedophile, but he was very lucky because he didn't get abused. Other boys got abused, but he didn't. But he can't understand how no action was taken in the school and the person removed, bearing in mind that the tremendous damage it did to victims. So a very confused Ken Clark. He went on to say this: "I suspect that the school staff over the years must have known, but for some peculiar reason, probably because of the threat to the reputation of the school. But even then, you could have quietly got him to leave, but they didn't. It went on." So puzzlement from this man. Why am I focusing on the school? Well, because Lord Lexton's part of his expertise is fighting for extra support for independent schools from the government. So I don't know. I just get a little bit of a mucky message here. And if we stay on the Conservative Party, of course, we should bring in Boris Johnson. So we've got a senior MP undermining the idea that children have been abused historically and particularly by politicians. And he uses this disgusting word of spaffed, 60 million up the wall. These are disgusting people.
I'm Mike. Afraid I have to agree with that.
Yeah. They are disgusting people. And they are running the country, so perhaps we shouldn't be surprised at the fact we're now into this chaotic constitutional system. It's going to get worse unless the public say no more and put a stop to it. After that, I think we should end on some good news, and F-35 would be the ideal place. I saw this a couple of days ago and I loved it because I thought, well, I need to put an alternative headline on this. So we're going to say a news flash that Prince Charles is to lead the failing F-35 programme. He was apparently asking if that was a knob.
Right.
Is this a knob? I don't know what the reply was. I did notice there was a warning which said, do not cut canopy within 3 inches of canopy frame. And this has led to an emergency EU meeting. Where they've withdrawn all support for the F-35 due to, quote, blatant anti-EU metrification discrimination.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I better put up that it was, of course, a Sky News article that the Royal Navy and the RAF were locked in a dogfight over the new jets because the RAF wants the long-range F-35, whereas, of course, the Navy wants the one it can launch from its carrier, well, allegedly. So there's a bit of a squabble going on there, but not to worry because Prince Charles has been handling some of the equipment.
But the problem is, of course, as we reported on Monday, there's no such thing as a long-range F-35 because they keep cracking up and so on.
This is true.
Killing their pilots.
Yeah.
But anyway, yes. Anyway, yes, OK.
We better end there. If you like what we do and you're not a subscriber to UK Column, please subscribe. We need your financial support to do what we do and to do more. And I'll just say that we had the pleasure of meeting an extremely brave French lady yesterday. My goodness, what she was been prepared to do for her country, absolutely tremendous. And it brings back into my mind the utter cowardice of senior retired British military officers. French lady versus senior military, no comparison. Mm. We'll leave it there. Bye-bye.